thank you everyone for coming. It's been a while. It's good to see faces here. Well, nothing, I just couldn't start up. Okay, here we go, folks. So it's been a lot, it's been like over 2 months since we've met. People have probably forgotten all the things. So I'm gonna try and do a little more thorough review. And starting from the last session, we were having a discussion of damages that were done by fire. One who kindles a fire and does not adequately safeguard it is liable to pay for the damage it caused. So the question being raised now in the Talmud is, what is one's liability for damage caused by fire? And just to remind you all that the kind of underlying reasoning is that for things that are usual, things that you have control over, you pay full damages, but for things that are unusual, you pay half damages. So with that, we're going to start with the second half of the Mishnah from last time. And it came up with a scenario. The dog that took a cake and went to a haystack, ate the cake and burned down the haystack. So what is the liability here for the owner of the dog? So for the cake that the animal stole, he pays full damages. Why again? Because that apparently he has control over. But for the haystack, which is unanticipated, which is unusual, he pays half damages. That's the Mishnah we start with.
Okay.
Now, first point was made last time was, why is this thing not like the other? If you'll remember, there were the four primary damagers, the Arba Avot Nezikin, and they were the ox, the pit, and the Mavet, which we finally decided was the crop-destroying beast, though that's not for 100% sure. So the question is, why is fire different than those three? Why is it not a subset of any one of the others? And the answer is that fire is qualitatively different because there is no direct link between the damage and the person responsible for it. So for example, if you light a fire and then the wind blows in a funny way and the fire spreads to your neighbor's property, that's different than the other three high-level damagers. So with that, we had a long discussion of how do we characterize fire? Do we characterize it like arrows or do we characterize it like property? And what's the difference? So this was a dispute between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, who were second generation Palestinian Amoraim, and they were famous study partners. So it's possible to have a study partner and disagree very much. So Rabbi Yochanan voted for arrows. And he said, why? Because a fire, you're responsible for fire in the same way you're responsible for an arrow that you would shoot. So the damage is not done directly, but it's clear that the owner has set the flame on its course, just like someone who shoots an arrow from afar and sets the arrow on its course. So that's one part. His opponent was Reish Lakish, and he said, no, you're responsible for fire in the same way you're responsible by damage done by any of your possessions. For example, fire is like ox. And there was a big question about what is really the practical difference between those two things, which will come to the end of the review. As always, the Talmud tries to characterize this by coming up with parallel cases and trying to squeeze them in together and see if it works. So we had three cases. The first was the camel in the marketplace. So you have a camel. You notice I always say you because I want you to feel the Talmud on you. You have a camel. It's carrying flax, which is flammable. and the flax gets lit and burns down a store or something like that, who's responsible for that damage? And of course, all three of these didn't work, but it was fun to look at them. The second was the case of the kid and the slave. Kid here in terms of a baby goat. So you have a baby goat that is chained to the ground. It's in front of a haystack, and next to it is a slave. And fire starts out, and the haystack gets burned down, and the kid gets burned up. Are you responsible? And in that case, the slave, we take it that the slave runs away. The alternative was to switch positions where the slave is chained by the haystack and the kid is free. And of course, the kid is not really smart enough to run away, and they die. There you are certainly liable, but you're not liable for damages. You're liable for the death penalty because you caused the death of a human being. So that was a different scenario. And finally, we had the famous triumvirate of people who are not responsible, meaning the deaf mute, the person who is mentally challenged, and the minor. And the reason those three are always grouped together is because they are considered to have no legal responsibility for their actions, although they do have what is called moral responsibility for them. So having made no headway with the parallels, we got into another scenario, which I called fire and fences, meaning you set a fire in your backyard and you have a fence between you and your neighbor. The fence gets blown down and the fire spreads and burns your neighbor's yard. And who's responsible in that case? Because it has the additional factor of there is a safeguard, the fence, but the fence falls down, which is nobody's fault, or is it? And don't ask me what the answer was to that. And finally, we come to the answer to what is the difference between arrows and property, because we went through all this work deciding it. And the answer is the five types of damage. So Rabbi Yochanan makes someone who damages by fire liable for four other payments that are incumbent upon a person that injures another person. And we've seen this before, and it's actually very modern in its thinking. Those four other factors other than damages, and this is on a person now, you have to pay them for pain, for medical expenses of healing, for unemployment, the loss of work while they recover, and finally for humiliation, which we pay if someone is beat up or disfigured. So those are the five payments, and depending on whether you consider fire, arrows, or property, you're responsible for those five types of damage. That's the review from last time. Any questions about that? Okay. Let's start the walk tonight. So we just had we had a Mishnah, and now we're going to start, as usual, by quoting the Mishnah and interrogating it to get at the deeper part of it. So the Mishnah starts with, for the cake he pays, and that's, again, the dog takes the cake by the haystack, eats the cake, and the haystack burns down.
What's the word for cake there? Hachirar?
Charara. Which is, I suspect, an Aramaic word.
Yeah, because it's not, you know, like we would think of uga.
Right.
Yeah, cake loaf is probably a better explanation, but it doesn't sound as appetizing to me. With cake. I thought you were going to say that the word is chara, which in modern Hebrew means a bad thing. I'll say dung to be proper.
Okay.
So it's the digestible food. So the Talmud asks the question, man chayav, who is liable? And the answer is Baal Kelev, the owner of the dog. But let the owner of the colt also be made liable. So the Talmud is assuming, which is a little bizarre here, that the cake and the colt were owned by two different people, you know, as if it's not complicated enough already.
Is the presumption here the coal, is it that the coal caused the fire? Is that the significance of the coal? Okay.
The coal definitely causes the fire. So the Talmud is asking here why the owner of the coal is not liable for damages that the fire made. And the answer is, the Mishnah assumes in the last sentence, he guarded his coal. So the owner of the coal was properly guarding his coal, therefore he's exempt from damages. Now, later the Talmud will adjust this, and you're going to see it's going to keep adjusting this so that the cake and the coal were owned by the same person, which is kind of, I think, what we all think going into this. But for now, the Talmud wants to explore the possibility that they are owned by two separate people.
The cake and the coal or the dog and the coal?
The cake and the coal. So we push back on the question about person guarding the coal. And coal, by the way, really means not a lump of black coal, but a live ember. So we call it coal, but that's really what we're talking about. It's a live coal. So if the owner of the coal was guarding his coal, what's the dog doing there? So how did the dog get the coal? And the answer is where he burrowed, meaning he broke in to the coal pile. I don't even know what to call it, the coal field, the place where the live coals were. That's what the where he burrowed means. And then we have Rav Mari, the son of Rav Kahana, who says, this is to say that ordinary doors are vulnerable to being burrowed by a dog. So what that means in simple English is, he's saying dogs are good at breaking down doors. And therefore, he must have been a dog lover, is the assumption you can make. And we'll see him back in a moment again. So that's the end of that discussion. And now we move along. So the next question is now where the dog ate the cake. Meaning, did he eat it in the yard of the cake owner, or did he eat it in the yard of where the haystack was? If we say he ate it at the haystack belonging to another person, we require, and then we have a proof text from Exodus, he devours in the field of another, which I hope you remember back from the ox. That was the case where the ox left your premises and went to someone else's field and started eating his crops. And that was the requirement, obviously, because if the ox eats your own crops, it's not anyone's problem. It's only when it eats your neighbor's crops. So we require, and that is not meaning it didn't happen. No, it is necessary where he ate it at the stack belonging to the owner of the cake. So if the dog stole the cake and ate it somewhere else, not where he stole it from, then he shouldn't be liable for eating the cake. The Torah seems to imply that in order to be liable, he must eat the cake on the premises of the owner of the cake. Therefore, this must be where he ate it. So based on this, the Talmud now wants to make an inference about the status of the mouth of the animal standing in the domain belonging to the party whose food it is eating. So you all remember, I hope, we had the domain of the damager and the domain of the damagee, or as I call him here, the damaged party. And if you remember, there were different penalties based on what location you're in. We also had private and public domains, but that's another story right now. So this and the next two slides all go together, and it's broken up because it's long and there's too much to fit on one page. So the Talmud makes this conclusion then, that the mouth of the cow, and of course we're talking about the dog, but it's the same thing, is like the domain of the damaged party. That's the damagee. For if it was like the domain of the damager, let him say to him, why is your bread, now it says bread, Michelle, instead of cake, in the mouth of my dog? In other words, if we consider the mouth of the damaged party's to be the mouth of the damaged party's domain, then the owner of the animal is obligated, is liable. But if we consider the mouth to be the damager's domain, then he's exempt. Because as we're going to see a few times, in the case of tooth, damages that are done by tooth must be done on the damaged party's domain. So this scenario here obviously then does not refer to the normal case, which you would think, where the animal just goes onto somebody else's property and eats. Because in that case, everyone agrees that the owner of the animal is liable. So there's a lot of different interpretations as to what this refers to. One interpretation says it's an animal that takes property from the public domain and brings it into the private domain. With regard to the situation we're talking about with the dog. So if the dog took the cake from one place and ate it on the property of the owner of the haystack, we can now assume that the mouth of the dog is like the damaged party's domain. Because if it was the domain of the damager could have blamed the owner of the cake for letting the dog eat it and therefore burn down the haystack. So I know that's a little complicated to grasp just looking at this, but we'll continue discussing this mouth issue. So the Talmud now wants to state the question formally, and it does so here. For it was asked very simply, is the mouth of the cow or the dog like the domain of the damaged party or the domain of the damager? Again, what everyone understands is, it's back to whose property the damage takes place on. And that's why the mouth of the animal becomes relevant here. So this might strike you as an odd question, and it strikes the Talmud as an odd question. If you say that it is considered to be the domain of the damager, how can you find tooth, and that's the capital tooth, that issue of eating things, where the merciful one makes liable? So the Talmud is wondering how you can even ask this question. If we consider the mouth of the animal to be the premises of the damager, when would a person ever be liable for damages done by the tooth, right? The dog, whoever's tearing paper, stop tearing paper.
Or just mute yourself.
Right, in other words, if my dog went on your property and ate your crops, and I could make the argument, well, the dog's mouth is my property, that would mean we could never have any damage done to you. So it makes the question absurd. Back comes our friend, Rabbi Mari, the dog lover, the son of Rabbi Kahana. So he wants to explore this example. He wants to find an example of a case where there is liability and it's considered the mouth of the domain. And he comes up with two cases. For an example, where it scratched up against the wall for its own benefit, or it dirtied produce, presumably by peeing or pooping on it, for its own benefit. So he's trying to come up with an example where the owner of the animal would be liable for the tooth damage, even if we consider the mouth to be the domain of the damaged party, where it does some other form of damage from which it derives benefit.
Steve, when they're providing these examples, are they hypotheticals, or are they expressing something that they believe that they've seen in practice?
I would say they're always hypotheticals.
Okay.
Because it's the way they test the law. It's like, I always think it's like a rubber sheet, and they're stretching it and exaggerating it to see where it makes sense. So Marzutra raised a difficulty. Do we not require as consumes the tooth until it all be gone? And it is not. So we have a proof text from Kings that says, tooth is when you eat something until it all goes away. And here we have Rav Mari coming up with two cases where that doesn't hold. In other words, these are cases of tooth that would render the animal's owner liable, according to one who holds the mouth of the cow is like the domain of its owner. So the two cases, again, where it rubs itself against the wall or it dirties produce. These cannot be in the category of tooth. So Ravina and Rav Ashi come here to offer possibilities where the animal could consume something completely without using its mouth. So one is where an animal rubs off images engraved on a wall. That's Ravina's answer. And Rav Ashi's answer is where it treads on something like produce until the produce is completely destroyed. Now, I'll say here that this entire exercise has been quite strange, right? The Talmud is trying to say that damages done by the high-level category of tooth are not really damages of tooth at all, but some other part of the body. And they're doing all of this so we can interpret the question of whether the mouth of an animal is considered to be the domain of the damaged or the damager, which in and of itself is a very strange question. And we still don't really have an answer to that. So with that, we're going to have now two baraita are going to be brought in to see if we can understand that. So we have our familiar tashma, which means come in here literally, which means we're going to bring up a baraita or a mishnah and see how it applies or not. In this case, it's actually a mishnah from the book, from the Sefer of Sanhedrin, which is related to court cases. And the mishnah is, if he incited a dog, he meaning the owner, against, or he incited a snake against, he is exempt. I'm going to take back what I just said, the owner. This is a person who incites an animal to attack another person. And the Mishnah says that he's exempt. Who is exempt? And now you have two parties, right? You have the owner of the animal and you have the inciter, and they're two different people. So again, I have a cat and Judy comes along, even though she counts as me, but, and she incites the cat to attack Steve Nagel. Who has to pay for the medical bills? Who's responsible, if anyone? And we have two opinions. No, we have one opinion. The one who incited is exempt, but the owner is liable. In other words, inciters pay no price.
That doesn't seem right.
And if you say that it is like the courtyard of the damager, you can say, in other words, it's being done on my property, so someone incited him, I could say, what is your hand doing in the mouth of my dog? Okay, so go back a step. Right? Why is the inciter exempt? The inciter does not commit a direct action of any kind. He is not knocking some property over. He's just inciting.
Isn't that the ultimate responsibility? Is the inciter? That's what.
Why?
Because that's the one that initiated the behavior that set the chain of things in motion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
it's the person who did the act.
Right. That would be my guess. The only person responsible, you know, you should have protected your animal. Why isn't it on a leash? But that's, you're right, Michelle. That's really the question here of who's responsible.
I would have gone with the insider too.
So to go back a moment.
Because I can understand the leash question. That makes sense to me, that the leash response.
All right. So go back to this whole concept of the mouth again. So if we say the mouth of the dog is like the damager's, the owner's premises, then the owner of the dog should say to the person the dog bit, what is your hand doing on my property? That's that last line. What is your hand doing in the mouth of my dog? Thus, he should be exempt under that thinking, right? Because we're still all trying to resolve the whole mouth question. Now, this sounds crazy, of course. You put your hand in the mouth of my dog, and therefore I am exempt. So I think the Talmud here is kind of going to a weird theoretical level where it's not really Lawrence expecting this to be case law. So two solutions are going to be offered to this. Say even the insider is exempt, and if you want, say that he extended his teeth and scratched him. So those are two parts to take one at a time. Even the insider is exempt. So the Mishnah does not mean only the insider is exempt. It meant even the insider is exempt. That's what we go back to here. Thus, no one is liable in this case. No one has liability. The second one is, say that he extended his teeth and scratched him. So, what if the dog did not bite the hand of the person such that the hand was in his mouth? In other words, the biting took place outside of the dog's mouth, meaning the dog might have scratched him with his tooth, but at no point was the hand inside the mouth. Okay, there's no way to construe this then as occurring inside the dog's mouth. And that's the argument they're trying to make here. So that's the first Tashma. And apparently the Talmud's not happy with it because it brings up a second one. So we have another Tashma. If a man caused a snake to bite. And now we're talking about a man who causes a snake to bite another person so that he dies. That's a different scenario here.
What if this serious question, what if the snake bites the dog?
The dog ain't part of it.
Oh, seriously, thank you.
Rabbi Yehuda makes him liable and the sages exempt him. Now, again, liable means liable for the death penalty, because you have caused the snake to bite a person and he dies, and that's death. So Rabbi Yehuda versus the sages now. And now we have Rav Ahabar Jacob saying he's going to explain both of these positions. You will find that according to the statement of Rabbi Yehuda, the poison of the snake is ready at its fangs. Therefore, as one who strikes with the sword, the snake is exempt. That's one argument. That's Rabbi Yehuda. And the words of the sages, the poison of the snake is secreted of its own free will. Therefore, the snake is put to death and the insider is exempt. All right. What this is a biology argument. And remember, again, we're going back to the mouth argument. Basically, does it take place within the mouth or outside the mouth? If you're considering the mouth to be like the damager's property. So let's go take them one at a time. Rabbi Yehuda holds the person liable for murder. Rav Ahabar Jacob explains that the poison of the snake is already in its fangs. Therefore, this person is a direct murderer and should be executed for the crime. The snake is like a sword. It's just a weapon. And that's how you consider it. Now, the sages have a different biology. The sages think that the snake needs to bite someone in order to get the venom flowing to kill the person. So we execute the snake because the snake killed the person. But the one who sends the snake out is exempt because, again, the rabbis only hold liability for death penalty if it is a direct action. Everyone get that? Those are the two differences. And by the way, I mean, my knowledge of biology would say, well, I won't say it actually. I would tend to go with the Rabbi Yehuda that the snake is ready to bite all the time. But I don't know. And I don't know if anyone's ever gone and made a biological argument about it. And now we're going to take the same reasoning we had a few slides ago. If you say the mouth of the cow is like the damager's courtyard, in other words, if you say the mouth of the snake is like the owner's property, then we can say to him, why is your hand in the mouth of my snake? It's the same argument. Now, clearly the Mishnah does not like this. Over and over, we've seen the Mishnah thinks the mouth of the animal is to be considered the property of wherever the animal is and is not automatically the private domain of the owner. This is why the Talmud keeps going back and forth on this question of mouth. All right, but now we throw both arguments out. We do not say this with regard to killing. Now, the Talmud says the whole discussion concerning the status of the mouth and animal has no bearing on the death penalty for murder. This is because murder does not depend on premises. In other words, it doesn't matter where the murderer occurs. The murderer is always liable. So even if the mouth is considered the owner's property or it's not property, it doesn't matter. The owner is still liable.
Is there a distinction between murder and manslaughter?
It's the same as an American law. Murder is...
But if you were inside a snake, wouldn't that be more like negligence and not really... So it'd be more like manslaughter? I don't know.
No, the Talmud, you're right. It's a good point, but the Talmud obviously considers it murder because it's direct.
Got it. Okay.
So the Talmud is now going to go prove that this is true, that when it comes to death penalty for murder, it doesn't matter where the premises are. And it starts with Talmudic terminology, which I did not go into, umina temra, which is a Talmudic term which says, what is the source for the halakha stated in the Mishnah or Baraita? The halakha is below, for it was taught. One who enters another's courtyard without permission and the owner's ox gores and he dies, the ox is stoned and the owner is exempted from the ransom. So what does this mean? So this is a case where an ox kills a trespasser. In that, according to the Torah, the law is, the halakha is, that the ox is executed. It is stoned to death, which doesn't mean what stone to death means, we think it means. They pressed large stones on it till it asphyxiated. Anyway, the ox is killed and the owner of the ox pays a ransom. Because in principle, the owner of the ox is also considered a murderer. But it's not a direct case. And it doesn't matter here that there was a trespasser, that a person came onto the premises without permission. Murder is murder wherever it occurs. Now,
it says here the owner is exempted.
Correct. That's what there's, yes, so there's a difference. So the word here is kofar. And kofar does mean ransom. It also means atonement, like Yom HaKippur, kofar hakol. But I want to get to that point. Ransom for what, you might say? It's literally ransom for your life. You're saying, I should be responsible for this, but I'm going to pay you off, and that eliminates my responsibility. Right. So, Michelle, the answer is because it's, in a sense, the owner is not responsible. I mean, he's morally responsible. He's not legally responsible.
Right. That's how I'm reading this sentence, that the owner is not responsible. They're exempted from ransom.
Maybe.
Okay. And the reason is, by the way, you cannot ransom for murder. There's no such thing. So now we go on to question this, because there's still payment involved. So it's quoting again, the owner is exempted from ransom. What is the reason? Because he can say, on my premises, what were you doing? The English is awkward here because I'm trying to literally translate it and show the two sentences together. So very, very clear. The owner is exempt here because the trespasser had no right to be on his property. Doesn't give the owner the right to commit murder, but it does absolve him of the responsibility for it. But you can also say, with his ox, why not use the same logic? What were you doing on my premises? In other words, I can't control the fact that my ox killed you. You had no right to be there. And the answer basically is, we don't say this when it comes to killing. So as far as payment goes, the fact that he came onto the other person's property without permission does make a difference with payment. The owner of the ox need not make the payment. And this proves, and now we're back to the mouth again, that there is a difference between executing for killing and making payments. Rather, it must be, we do not say that this principle applies with regards to matters relating to the death penalty. Consequently, we really can't learn anything about the mouth of the cow from this halakha. It's what this all comes out to. Okay, so we're going to go away from the mouth now, you may be happy to know. And we're going to talk about something a little more fun. And we have a story. So the goats of the Tarbu family, I have no idea who they were, but they were doing damage to Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef tells his pupil, Abaye, some things don't change, go tell the owners of the goats that they have to fence them in, keep them intact. And Abaye is kind of not very deferential to his master, says, what's the point? If I go to them, they're going to say, all right, tell your master to put a fence up, and then he won't have this problem. And this is a classic, right, neighbor thing. So just out of curiosity, what do you infer from Abaye's answer? Is it the responsibility of the owner or the neighbor? And I would say it seems like the burden of protecting your property is on the owner of the property, not on the owner of the potentially offending animals. Okay, but if he did put up a fence, how can you find tooth for which the merciful one obligated? Meaning, you put up the fence, and now we get back again to that legal category of tooth for which you are responsible for that. This would be your neighbor, the owner of the goats, would be responsible for damages done to your property. That was the halakha we had till now. Why is this not the same? And again, we get two answers. When it burrows, this is like our clever dog, meaning the animal breaks into the property despite a fence, or when the fence fell at night. So the fence broke and the owner would not have seen it. In both of these cases, the owner of the animal would be liable. But in normal cases, if my animal goes onto your unfenced property, it's your fault for not putting up a fence. Okay, now this is interesting always because to me it's slice of life in ancient times. So we've been talking about Rav Yosef. So here's another Rav Yosef story. Rav Yosef, and some say Rabba, would proclaim, those that go up as well as those that go down. Now, let's start with that. What does that mean? So those that go up are literally aliyah. And that in ancient times, we had two centers of learning. We had Eretz Yisrael and we had Babylonia. And the rabbis went back and forth all the time. So the rabbis that went from Babylonia to Eretz Yisrael were those that go up. They were making aliyah, literally. And rabbis that traveled from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia are those that go down. So what he's saying here is all of these people are included. There's nothing special. And we'll get to why that's interesting in a moment. Well, right off the bat, you can see it's whatever legislation is coming applies in both places. And if you remember from the past, we often had the case where the Babylonian rabbis were like second rate compared to the Palestinian rabbis and didn't have the same authority over their people and had to defer to their rulings. So here's legislation that appears everywhere. And here it is. So goats that go into the market and do damage. You bring your goats into the marketplace, they eat something from a stall. We warn them two or three times. If the owner heeds, he heeds. If he ignores us, we say to him, I like this, sit next to the butcher shop and take your money. In other words, keep your goats in line or they're going to end up on a meat hook much quicker than you expect. And you're not going to get market prices for them. So that's the story here. Again, another thing you can draw out of this is it seems like the Babylonian rabbis did have authority over their local Jewish population. And we've talked about the Babylonian rabbis deferring to the Israeli rabbis. And they didn't seem to have very much power over their own Babylonian Jews. Now, it's very hard to tell from sources like this throughout the Talmud how many people actually would have listened to their threats. Also, we might wonder if this source was issued by a rabbi or whether the rabbi was affirming something that the local leaders say. So that's the story. And with that, we come to really the whole end of the sugya, excuse me, about the mouth. And we're going to move into a new Mishnah. So this is the fourth Mishnah in chapter 2. And just as an introduction, right, we have spent a lot of time talking about the two types of animal, the tam, which is the harmless animal, and the muad, which is the known dangerous animal, right? But we have mostly talked about the different consequences for those two animals. Now we want to go in a different direction, which is, how do we define these two things? What makes an animal a muad? What makes an animal a tam? And another question we haven't thought about at all, can one transform into the other? So we know that an innocent animal can transform into a dangerous animal. Can a dangerous animal transform back into an innocent animal? And once again, in terms of liabilities, the owner of the dangerous animal pays full damages from the best of his land. And the owner of the innocent animal only pays half damages, and even then only up to the value of the animal. So that's the introduction to this Mishnah. And here, I really want you to put on your thinking caps and figure out the basis for the two, because you know we're going to have two separate opinions. Why does each rabbi says what they do? So the question is, Ezehu Tam, the Ezehu Muad. What is a Tam and what is a Muad? Muad, where it was testified, and there's literally why the word Muad comes from, the same root as testified, 3 days. In other words, that it was witnesses came and said it gored on 3 days. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. And a tam, where it reverses for 3 days. In other words, it goes 3 days without goring. Then it becomes a tam. And this is the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir, his opponent, says a muad is where it was testified about three times. In other words, three different people came and testified about it. Well, I'm not even going to say that because that's a question we'll talk about. And what makes it go back to a tom? If children can touch it and it doesn't harm them. That's the basic answer. Now, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda are fifth generation Tanaim, and they are two of the most famous rabbis in the Mishnah. And in fact, whenever a Mishnah is stated without a source, it almost always is considered to be Rabbi Meir. So those are the two different opinions. And if anyone wants to jump in with a guess as to really what their differentiation is, feel free, but the door will still be open as we move along. Okay, so let's talk about the proof text for this. So we have a verse in the book of Exodus, chapter 21, verse 36. Or if it was known that the ox gored in time past and the owner has not guarded it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his own. So the plain meaning of the text is a dangerous ox kills another ox. The owner of the dangerous ox has to pay for the ox it killed, and he gets to keep the carcass of the dangerous ox. Now we start doing a little biblical interpretation. So you see the letters in green, Mitmol Shloshim. What does that mean? So first, let's take the first word, Mitmol, and cut off the mem, and we get the word Timol. Timol means either yesterday or recently. It's kind of like in English. It's very much like in English. If I told you this happened the other day, that could literally mean it happened yesterday, or it could mean it happened a couple of days ago. Timol. Mi timol means from yesterday. So now you can argue that that's 2 days here. From yesterday could be yesterday and the day before it, or again, it could mean recently. Shloshim, we know, is three. So now we can read this whole thing two different ways. We could read it as 2-3 days ago, meaning literally, or we could read it as recently. And that's the English I have here in green, in time past, because you can read it both ways. Does everyone get this? Because this is going to be the basis of many arguments. Okay, so we had the Mishnah. This is our interlude of the proof text, and now we go to the Gemara's discussion of the Mishnah. So we first start with Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda said a muad is where it was testified on 3 days, and a tom was where it was testified that it was good on 3 days. So Abaye is going to explain Rabbi Yehuda. Now, the arguers here are Abaye and Rava, and they were fourth generation Babylonian Amoraim, basically the head of the two greatest academies in Babylonia. You can think of them as the Harvard and Yale of Babylonia. These were the two presidents. And they are 150 years later than Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, who are making the arguments. So this is similar to us debating the presidential election of 1872. Today, Ulysses Grant versus Horace Greeley. So I'm just trying to give you a little context for how this argument goes. So Abaye is explaining Rabbi Yehuda, and it's pretty much what I was saying before. So yesterday, tmol means one. Mi tmol, from yesterday, means two. Shloshim means the day before yesterday, three. And the rest of the verse, and the owner has not secured it, means day four. And Abaye understands here that the first three times the ox gores, it is Tom, and the owner is liable for full damages only on the fourth time. So what is the yardstick here? What is he measuring, Abaye? And this is back to the what differentiates the two points of view. And the answer is his yardstick is time. He's using the passage of days for the three. And that's where he's getting this argument. That's how he's understanding Rabbi Yehuda. But Rava, his counterpart, reads the verse very differently. So, Mol meet Mol, he reads as one, Shloshim, two, and he has not secured it. Now he is liable. So, what is Rava's yardstick? What is he talking about? He's not talking about time, he's talking about gorings, or I will call it events. So that is back to our, again, discussion of the 3 days. The question, is it a time? Is it 3 days of time? Or is it three gorings? And that's what the whole discussion now is going to be about.
So Steve, I have a question.
Yes.
So on that, going back on the first one, there's definitely the shalosh. I see that. But on the others, it's not Shloshim, it's Shilshom, which is the same root. Granted, it's definitely the same root, but the grammar is different. It's Shilshom.
Correct. So you're right. It's not and it's not Shalosh either.
The root, it's the same root. It's the root for
right.
It's Shin Lamed Shin. But I don't know what to make of that Shilshom rather than Shloshim.
So this is Mishnaic Hebrew. I will not pretend to tell you I have expertise in it. I think your point is very good. I think probably the way to read that would be like third rather than three.
Okay, I could buy that.
So it's kind of one, two, three. And again, I think the English is very good. 2-3 days ago. Right, you can understand that literally, or you can understand that figuratively. So this is where, so to go back again to Rava is saying three gorings, very contemporaneous to us. This is like the felony law, three strikes and you're out. Rava saying you commit the offense three times, you're liable, you're a muad. Now, let's talk about Rabbi Meir, his opponent. What is his reason? And again, we go back to here, to the Mishnah. So Rabbi Meir is now talking about whether it was testified about three times. And his other thing is not quite a parallel, that children can touch it and it won't gore. So how do we understand Rabbi Meir? So we learn in a Baraita, Rabbi Meir said, if it spreads his gorings, he is liable. Concentrating his gorings, how much more so? So Rabbi Meir is now saying, we don't need three consecutive days. We're talking about three gorings, three events. And he derives this from a kal vachomer, an all the more so argument, which is, what if all three gorings occurred on one day, right? If you were doing it by the day status where it's over 3 days, that wouldn't matter. But if you were doing it by the event counter, it's three gorings, even if they occurred on the same day and the same time. So that is his argument. Now, the rabbis don't like this argument. That is the they, and they said to him, and as usual, they're going to go and pick another type of thing to make their argument. And this type of thing is genital discharges. This is where you never know where the Talmud will take you. So there is a category in the Torah of a zav, male, and a zava, female. And these are people who have genital discharges, which are not sexual discharges. They're more like disease discharges. Yes, Judy's amused at this. So I have to go in and explain that. So a zava is a woman with a genital discharge. And the question is, what makes her or her counterpart, the male zav, to be in a state of ritual impurity by these discharges? And the rabbis say, if her sightings are spread, she is impure. If her sightings are concentrated, she is pure. So if she has these discharges over a period of time, I won't even say the 3 days, then she's got something. It's not a one-off. So they're arguing, and that makes her impure. 3 separate sightings. If she basically has one at once, then that doesn't really count as a real genital discharge, and she is not impure. So again, it's time versus events. So Rabbi Meir responds. He said to them, behold, it surely says, and now we have a proof text from Leviticus, the first of 3 in a row, because all this stuff about purity and impurity is in the book of Leviticus. And this shall be his impurity when he has a discharge. The verse associates the zav, that's the male, with sightings, and the zava with days. So again, we got to look at the equivalent. So the zav's impurity depends on how many discharges he has. If he has 3 on one day, he is impure. And Rabbi Meir is emphasizing the words, and this, vizot. Like we say, lahavdil, vizot ha-Torah, and this is the Torah. And this shall be his impurity. He's going to try and draw a strong lesson on that. So this is how a zav becomes impure, but not how a zava becomes impure. Okay, that's the argument he is making here. And in this piece of Gemara, we have a direct quote of the Torah, Leviticus 15:3, but the bottom half refers to a second biblical proof text. The verse associates the zav with sightings and the zava with days, and that proof text is further down in the same chapter. V'isha ki azuv zov dama yamim rabim. And if a woman have an issue again is a discharge. I probably should have made that. You see the word zuv zov, of her blood, many days. So why do we have this proof text, and what does it show? Because it specifically says a woman has an issue of her blood. So how do we know that the zot and this excludes a zava from sightings? Say to exclude a zav from days. It's actually kind of reverse logic, right? Rabbi Meir is saying the word "and this" means when a zav has 3 discharges on one day, he is impure, but a zava means 3 days. But why not read the verse as saying, if a zav has 3 discharges on different days, he is not impure? The answer is that we have a third verse, which is now quoted. The verse says, and concerning one who has a discharge, male or female. So what does this bring to the fore? It brings to the fore that it explicitly compares the zav and the zava. It says male and female. So in both of these cases, the text says it's counting by days. So he says, okay, just as a female counts by days, so too a male should count by days. But the Talmud pushes back against this. But let us compare female to male. just as a male is by discharges, so also a female by discharges. Why not say that verse 33 compares, that's the one we just had, compares men and women and teaches that for both of these three discharges on one day makes them impure? And the answer is back to the word in the first verse, and this. This is the verse Rabbi Meir used to rule that if a man has three discharges in one day, he is impure, a man, not a woman. And our last slide. The Talmud now asks again why we use verse 3 to exclude women from the rule of three. It can teach something different. And what do you see? Which is a weird, I don't know if they mean metaphorically, like what's the point? Or do they literally mean, do you see discharges? I've not figured that out from context. So it makes sense that it deals with sightings, exclude sightings, but it deals with sightings to exclude days. So in English, that means the verse 3 is about discharges, not about days. Therefore, it comes to teach us a rule about multiple discharges on one day and not on separate days. So at this point, we seem to have gone on a tangent, right? We haven't got back to the Tom versus Muad. This is the wonderful world of Gemara, and you don't know where it's going to take you. To be continued. Any questions on this? And we are done. That was long and it was a little complicated, but that was where we wound up.